This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian. Here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. And this is the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks so much for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of December 8th, 2025. Long before World War II, the U.S. rounded up Native Americans and forced them onto reservations. After the Pearl Harbor bombing in 1941, the U.S. rounded up another minority population, Japanese Americans. And in Arizona, the federal government once again looked to Indian reservations. As part of a week-long series on the state's World War II internment camps, Gabriel Pietrazio explains why.
None of the eight other internment camps in the U.S. were on tribal lands, so why here in Arizona? UCLA anthropology professor Koji Lau Ozawa has an answer.
John Collier, who was the commissioner of Indian Affairs at the time, advocated for all of the camps to be put on reservation lands. He thought that the Office of Indian Affairs was well suited to this task of managing these confined racialized populations.
The Indian New Deal, as FDR called it, was part of the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934 and tried making amends for past treatment by investing in tribal infrastructure. That was until the war effort began.
Funds were starting to dry up. This presented an opportunity.
An opportunity to turn Japanese Americans into a source of prison labor to develop tribal resources. As shown by a 1943 propaganda film narrated by Dwight Eisenhower's brother, Milton, about an internment camp in western Arizona.
At Parker, they undertook the irrigation of fertile desert lands.
Brian Nia says the U.S. embraced a stereotype.
Japanese Americans, with their supposed expertise in farming and agriculture, could help build up the land that would allow for the Native Americans to benefit from it. Without the consent of the tribes themselves, of course.
Nia is editor of Densho Encyclopedia, which chronicles the camp's history. Without much legal representation or political clout at that time, the Gila River Indian community and Colorado River Indian tribes both tried fighting camp construction but failed.
Through the Office of Indian Affairs, I think there was just a thought that we could bulldoze our way through.
Internment was also an issue for the Navajo Nation.
They did pass a resolution for the use of the boarding school to help in the war effort against alien enemies. Didn't say anything about imprisoning Japanese American citizens.
Davina Two Bears is a Dinette archaeologist at ASU's School of Human Evolution and Social Change, who has been unearthing research about the Old Loop Boarding School near Winslow. Named after Francis Loop, Teddy Roosevelt's commissioner of Indian Affairs, the school opened in 1909, once housing 500 children, before suddenly shutting down in 1942. A year later, the Interior Department turned it over to the U.S. War Relocation Authority, one of dozens of smaller facilities nationwide called isolation centers. As many as 80 Japanese Americans were held captive at Loop.
With no due process, no idea of why they were there, how long, no lawyers, of course. And it's interesting that it's imprisonment at a boarding school on indigenous lands.
Once again, today's federal government is butting up against tribal land. The Trump administration's alligator Alcatraz is being built near the Big Cypress National Preserve and Everglades National Park.
We're right in the middle of it. We have tribe members that live within 500 feet of the detention center. You know, it's not like this distant thing that it is for a lot of Floridians.
Talbert Cypress is chairman of the 600-member Miccosukee tribe, which brought alligator Alcatraz to a halt.
That area was pretty much seized by the state, and they fast-tracked it without any consultation with us, without any environmental study.
A federal judge sided with them and a pair of environmental plaintiffs, including the Tucson-based Center for Biological Diversity, in the tribe's last resort to stop the detention center.
We don't go to war anymore with a tomahawk or anything like that. You know, we go to courtrooms now and we go to meetings with politicians.
Alligator Alcatraz is part of the Trump administration's sweeping immigration crackdown.
Leave now. If you don't, we will find you. And we will deport you. You will never return.
Under Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, ICE has detained nearly 70,000 people this year alone. Two Bears fears history could be repeating itself.
Taking them away from all of their family and belongings, and that's what happened to Japanese Americans in 1943 and indigenous people during colonization. We've all lost so much.
Gabriel Pietrazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Find the entire series on Arizona's internment camps at kjzz.org. In politics news, a Republican state lawmaker is calling for Arizona's health department to roll back its guidance for hepatitis B vaccines following controversial changes at the CDC. Catherine Davis Young reports.
The CDC has long recommended all babies get a hepatitis B vaccine within 24 hours of birth and then two more doses in the months after. But a CDC advisory panel this month said if mothers don't have the virus, they should discuss with their doctors whether to get the vaccine for the baby. The American Academy of Pediatrics called the change irresponsible, and the Arizona Department of Health Services said it will still recommend the shot for all newborns. But State Representative Lisa Fink says Arizona should align with federal guidance.
With parents, we should be able to, review and determine if this is safe for our children.
Fink says the state's stance is an outdated one-size-fits-all policy. Catherine Davis Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. Spot 127's Youth Media Center provides high school students instruction in digital skills that prepare them for college and the workforce of tomorrow. And with your Arizona State tax credit, you can make a difference in their future. Visit spot127.org for details. In education news, the Scottsdale Unified School District will close and repurpose two schools due to declining enrollment and a several million-dollar budget shortfall. As Bridget Dowd reports from the Education Desk, the plan will displace nearly 600 students.
The closures of Pima Elementary School and Echo Canyon School are expected to save the district about $2.5 million. The board narrowly approved the decision at Tuesday night's meeting. More than 20 people spoke at public comment, most asking the board to explore other options before closing their schools. Pima parent Kat Ingolito said the decision-making process was flawed.
The district is pursuing a massive decision, the closure of several schools, without even forming a community budget committee. How can we expect the community to trust this process when we haven't even allowed all stakeholders to look at all ways to cut our current administrative costs?
In October, board member Amy Carney had asked to establish an advisory committee to support decision-making on key district issues, but it ended up on the same agenda as the school closure decision. Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In business news, a new state program awarded its first water credits this week to support the development of more than 800 homes in Buckeye. Cameron Sanchez reports.
State lawmakers created the Ag to Urban program earlier this year, which allows agricultural users to sell their land and water rights to housing developers in areas where groundwater use is restricted, like the West Valley. The program went into effect in September. Senator T.J. Shope sponsored the original legislation and says it's a win-win for farmers and developers.
We killed two birds with one stone. We know that we have willing sellers in many cases, and those willing sellers are members currently of the ag community, which we know is a high water use.
A spokesperson for the Department of Water Resources says there are several other ag to urban applications in the pipeline. The approved water project is expected to save 437 million gallons of water a year, since residential areas use less water than agriculture. Cameron Sanchez, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Fronteras News, President Trump says he will put an additional tariff on Mexico if it doesn't send over water it owes the U.S. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum said this week that her country intends to send more water to the United States, but not immediately. From the Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Nina Kravinsky has more.
Mexico is behind on water deliveries it owes the U.S. under a treaty signed in 1944. Trump said on social media that if Mexico doesn't deliver 200,000 acre-feet of water by the end of the year, his government will implement a 5% tariff on the country. That's just around a quarter of what Mexico owes under the treaty. At a press conference, Mexico's subsecretary for North America, Roberto Velasco, said years of drought in the country have made it impossible to keep up with deliveries to the U.S.
Pero estamos, por supuesto, tratando.
We are, of course, trying to come to an agreement that allows us to distribute the water we have right now fairly, Velasco says. Rosario Sanchez, a Texas A&M researcher who studies water sharing between Mexico and the U.S., says Trump's tariff threat puts pressure on Mexico.
But it won't bring more water to the system. We need to understand that.
Last month, Texas Republicans introduced a bill to Congress that would allow the president to retaliate against Mexico for missed water deliveries. Texas farmers have long called for Mexico to become more regular with those deliveries, which some rely on for irrigation. Nina Kravinsky, KJZZ News, Hermosillo.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In health news, Arizona has reported more than 900 cases of whooping cough in 2025. That's the highest case count in more than a decade. Here's Catherine Davis-Young once again.
Pertussis cases started rising nationwide in 2024 and climbed even higher this year. Dr. Raina Patel with Phoenix Children's Hospital says pertussis is known as whooping cough because it causes severe coughing fits or difficulty breathing.
Pertussis is also known as the 100-day cough, so it's not just a small cold that gets over in a couple of days. Once you're infected, the symptoms can last up to 3 months almost. So we really want to try to prevent this.
She says it's especially risky for babies under 6 months. Arizona's vaccination rates for whooping cough have been falling. About 89% of the state's kindergartners were vaccinated last year, compared to about 94% a decade earlier. Catherine Davis-Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, from KJZZ's The Show. From rage bait to AI slop to parasocial, the words of the year help explain 2025. Here's co-host Sam Dingman.
It is awards season, and it's not just books, music, and movies that are being recognized for their cultural impact. Every year since 1990, major language organizations like the American Dialect Society and Merriam-Webster announce their picks for the word of the year. As you may have seen, the cryptic phrase 6-7 took the prize from the voters at dictionary.com this year, and other winners have been rolling out steadily over the last few weeks. Stefan Fatsis is a writer who covers the history of language and how we use it. He recently wrote a piece for LitHub about the word of the year phenomenon. It was adapted from his book, Unabridged, The Thrill of and Threat to the Modern Dictionary. I spoke with him last week about the very first word of the year and how the annual tradition has evolved.
Yeah, that first word of the year was bush lips, meaning insincere political rhetoric. It was a reference to George Bush running for president, saying, read my lips, no new taxes,
right.
The elder George Bush.
That word's fairly quick fade in relevance. It prompted this bigger conversation about how a word of the year should be chosen and what that choice should reflect. Tell us a little bit about how the debate evolved.
What emerged quickly was this notion that a word to represent an entire year had to have had some traction. The evolution of word of the year in the last 35 years has definitely tilted more toward slang and things that have bubbled up on Twitter culture, social media. And these are just part of it's just normal linguistic evolution. The way we think about words changes over time. And social media have certainly had this dramatic effect on the way words are created, spawned, disseminated, and then consumed.
Well, something about this social media context really reminds me of one of my favorite lines from the piece you wrote about this. And the line is, quote, as a culture, we're forever searching for ways to make sense of our big, complicated, confusing world. Word of the year neatly boxes up 365 days in a single, simple word. It's media catnip and hot take gold. And one of the things that made me think about is that the word of the year, it seems like, has evolved into something that, like, we're because of social media, we're often looking for something to collectively argue about.
Absolutely. I mean, we're always looking for things to argue about, right? I mean, the other parallel I make is it's no different than arguing about who's better, LeBron or Jordan.
Yeah, right.
These sorts of conversations fuel social media.
Yeah.
So what started as this academic exercise, and has continued to be that with the Dialect Society, has sort of morphed into this marketing opportunity for dictionaries now at a time when dictionaries are struggling. And that's all good for business, but I think it's also good for society. Word of the Year is just one more opportunity to dissect who who we are as people and where our culture is at any given moment.
So, I mean, as evidenced by Bush lips, there has always been a sort of a political valence to the word of the year. But there was a shift in the tone of the debate in 2016.
The vote for the 2016 word of the year was held in January of 2017 in Austin, Texas, at a linguistics conference, which is where it's held every year. Trump had just been elected to his first term. And the discourse was all Trump all the time. And looking back on this, it's a reminder of just how much language was transformed and dominated by that election. Basket of deplorables, post-truth, alt-right, fake news. There were so many terms that overwhelmed the media conversation. And the winner was dumpster fire, right. And it beat woke. And that vote to me is really interesting because woke was sort of at its peak for its old now meaning progressive, aware, right. Mm-hmm. Which is how that word evolved from African-American vernacular English. You can date it back into the 1930s with a rise in the 1960s and again in the 90s. And since then, woke has been twisted into a pejorative. And dumpster fire is still just a dumpster fire. So words have these first acts, second acts, third acts.
Well, in the vein of all of this, Stefan, I wonder if we could just step quickly through the word of the year selections that have been announced so far. I'd love to get your take on how they fit into what we've been talking about. First, let's go with the Oxford Dictionary has decided to go with rage bait.
Rage bait is content online that's deliberately provocative. And that word fits in with where we are culturally right now, this period of uncertainty and hate and violence. So that sort of threads the needle that a good word of the year should thread. Something that has gained a lot of popularity, and that is, you can prove that by looking at databases, which is what Oxford and other dictionaries do, but it's directly related to where we are as a culture.
Let's move now to the choice by the Macquarie Dictionary. They have decided to go with AI slop.
Yes, that's an Australian dictionary. And if you're going to pick a word of the year, you can't go wrong picking one that is connected to AI, because it has dominated the discourse, the sort of non-political discourse, but again, with overlap into politics, because AI is a concern for how conversations are happening online and the reliability of words and the abuse of this new technology. And that's where the slop part comes in.
So next up, we have Cambridge Dictionary, and they have gone with a word that, and I'm curious to know if you disagree with this, but to me felt a couple years out of date, which is parasocial.
Yeah. Parasocial does feel a little bit older, but again, Cambridge says massive increase in lookups for this term. They pegged it to Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce, you know, viral characters in our online discourse. What I found interesting about their explanation for parasocial was that it emerged from academia a long time ago. Parasocial dates to 1956, according to Cambridge. Wow. And that's not uncommon with words that have emerged in as important an academic coinage that didn't emerge popularly in culture for decades.
I have to say, one of the other things that's interesting about stepping through all of these choices is there is something kind of neatly boxing up, to borrow your phrasing, of this year, that in a year where AI slop seems like one of the most relevant things to the folks at Macquarie, parasocial is relevant to the folks at Cambridge, AI slop being, you know, fake stuff that is trying to be passed off as real, and parasocial referring to relationships with real people that people feel like they have, but of course, unless they are personal friends with Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift, don't.
It's almost like words of the year should be like a team, because collectively they do a great job of explaining what happened in the last year. Even if individually they might not, you get this nice range that sort of bottles up what we were about for the last 365 days.
Well, for more on the befuddling and fascinating history of words, what they mean, and the role of the dictionary in how we use them, my guest Stefan Fatsis has a whole book about it. It's called Unabridged: The Thrill of and Threat to the Modern Dictionary. Stefan, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Sam. Appreciate it.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more, online, and on the KJZZ mobile app.